the Quick Stop Entertainment QuickCast series featuring filmmaker Terry Gilliam. Part 1.
Just as a filmmaker, what you've experienced in the past 10 years as far as, I mean, I'm sure Tideland, and we'll talk about that in a second, I'm sure that you know, were able to cut most of that instantly.
It's, actually finishing Brothers Grimm is the first film I've done digitally. That's how behind the times I was. It's like fear and loathing on film.
But would you say that's behind the times, or just...
I don't know, it was actually, because the producer at the time was convinced it was going to cost more to do it digitally, but he was wrong. And then, so Grimm's is that, I mean, this is like Final Cut Pro, I've never got my head around it, iMovie is all I need.
but you can make things that look beautiful in the simplest of programs nowadays.
Oh yeah, no, it's just... I mean, I did some years ago, there was a Python, you know, I don't know, 35 years on the BBC, and I did the first animation I'd done in years, and I just used After Effects, Adobe After Effects, and whipped something together in no time at all, and I loved it because I didn't have to get deep into the technology. I kept it at sort of the level of my cutouts, and that's about page 2 in the manual.
And you produced stuff that was, I'm just assuming, far faster and sharper looking than you ever accomplished.
I could have more moving things than I could ever hope to do with normal cutouts. The great thing about the computer is once you make a chicken, you can make 100 chickens.
But do you think, you know, to some extent, as a filmmaker, that's a line that you have to be careful of?
No, in this instance, it was fine. I'm always trying to find a balance between the technology, what's available out there, and not getting too trapped in it. I don't know. I mean, I sort of just fumble my way through all of it, and I don't want to get too skilled at any of it. I like the fact that it's a slight rough edge. I mean, when it comes to film itself, I mean, I can do it to whatever standard is needed. I'm more and more been theorizing in my own head about CG work and the idea of trying to be so naturalistic with it, and it's kind of lost its magic because it was just, you know, recreating reality. There's no big leap going on there.
Yeah, but I think that's also the uncanny valley that all these CG features are starting to, you know, like the animated features like DreamWorks has been putting out with Shrek and such.
Yeah.
Where you're going, well, why did you try and make a human character look as close to a human character?
I know. I don't actually like the look of Shrek. Shrek is saved by the script and the performance.
Right, but as a film, it's a very ugly...
Yeah, I agree.
Ugly film in the way it's designed.
Yeah, that's why I prefer Pixar. Because Pixar, the sheen of Pixar is really beautiful. I just love it, actually. And you know, they were playing in toys, things like that. I think the worst one was, remember years ago when DreamWorks first started up and they did, what was it called, The Prince's Egypt?
Yes.
Moses and the Burning Bush and all that. And they were trying to be as realistic as they could. And it was just awful getting these cartoon characters to try to have the subtlety of real people. And number one, you can't do it, and number two, you don't want to do it.
Well, no, I mean, that was the beauty of animation, is to do things that you in no way could accomplish.
Yeah.
And to exaggerate through illustration.
Yeah. That's the leap, and that's why I keep thinking, that's what I think on some level was one of the problems with King Kong. It just didn't demand any of your imagination to go to work.
Well, there's
it was done for you.
Well, there's John Byrne, a comic book writer and artist, had a good observation about King Kong. You know, when watching it, he was comparing it to, you know, the original film. He said, when you watch the original film, the way Kong is designed, it's King Kong.
Yeah.
The way you look at how realistic Peter Jackson's Kong is designed, you're going, that's just a giant ape.
Yeah. You know, because that's exactly right. Your brain makes the leap from that, you know, little puppet in the first one, And it fills it into something wonderful. I mean, I keep thinking that's why people do puppet shows. That's why we used to do animation cartoons. That's what theater is about. It gets the audience, you know, using their imagination to fill up the gaps between that and reality.
But I think what happened, I mean, you have people doing animation nowadays. I mean, you know, the way the modern Disney method evolved into, like, DreamWorks was people like Jeffrey Katzenberg, who came in from live action, trying to make it, well, I can do live action with animation.
Yep.
I mean, that's why they're
weird about what Zemeckis is doing. I mean, he obviously got into it with Polar Express and now with Beowulf. And it's going to be, you know, as naturalistic as they can make a thing. And I just think, what are we doing here?
Yeah, but no one, I mean, everyone I talked to who liked Polar Express, and I really didn't like Polar Express.
I still haven't seen it. I just saw bits of it. I didn't like the look of it.
Oh, yeah, well they'd say, oh, you know, the train is beautiful or the environment is beautiful, but no one actually said, gosh, those humans are beautiful. No, them, they're creepy zombies.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you can't get, I mean that was a thing that animators learned years ago about rotoscoping, is that you can shoot reference video and you can do some rotoscoping, but too much rotoscoping just looks too intense.
Yeah.
Because then, again, that uncanny valley, once you get too close to something, people will start going, well, why isn't it exactly that?
Exactly. I mean, then you're right, because I think it's the promise that's there that isn't quite delivered, and then people then become very critical. They've cheated me somehow.
Yeah, well, why are their eyes kind of glassy like that? Why are they coming after my children?
That's why I'm sticking with cutout animation.
But I think, you look at that, and, look at the things that you did with Python, look at Rocky and Bullwinkle,
yeah,
and you look at how limited that was in animation. Yeah. You know, the fact is, most of it was implied animation.
Exactly.
Or South Park.
Yeah. No, but that's why I love South Park. I mean, and it does, because it is, I mean, I was convinced when they did the first movie there was no way that would sustain 90 minutes, but they did it. And it was, I mean, because again, it's the material is what makes it work. And it's because of the crudity of the thing, I think you forgive it for so much stuff.
Well, it just, the skill and the craft behind the writing, and particularly the music in that film.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that obviously you put to good effect with the Python animations was when you would bring music into it.
Of course.
And I think that's a skill that's lost today when you don't actually have things that are constructed for film. You look at the DreamWorks films or the modern Disney films, and it's pop soundtracks.
Yeah.
Whereas you look at something like even during the brief Disney Renaissance with Ashman and Menken,
mm-hmm,
where they said, no, let's have songs in service to the film that carry through character. And I think that, essentially character has been lost.
Well, that was the great strength of their stuff. Their material was so good because it was character, and it was brilliant. And then we had to move on from that to get Tim Rice writing lyrics and things. And we just started thinking at that point.
Well, I forgot who was talking about the fact that when Elton John originally brought in his demos,
yeah,
for Lion King, his demos,
yeah,
everyone was just despondent.
Why?
Because it was, 90s era happy Elton John.
Right.
You know, the pure schmaltz Elton John. And they go, what can we do with this? We have this, film set in, the African savannah, and we got Elton John's 90s greatest hits. And then these tracks were turned over to Labo M.
Uh-huh.
Who then, infuse them with some kind of life and energy.
Uh-huh.
And Labo M essentially was, pushed aside when the recognition time came. No, no, look at the wonderful job that Tim Rice and Elton John did on these amazing songs.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the things they did to placate Labo M, kind of like acknowledgement of the fact that we just shafted you, was that Rhythm of the Pride Lands CD, which they essentially turned over the sequel CD, saying, here, we'll pay you, get your friends, whatever you want to do to release this thing.
That's amazing. I still haven't seen Lion King. Unfortunately, I had to watch it in the theater on stage. And I just, oh, God. I mean, there are moments in there that are quite good and quite beautiful. But I'd say the majority, it was just, oh, God, it made me crazy.
I mean, you look at something like that, I mean, and the fact that everything now is being translated to stage at Disney. Yeah. The Little Mermaid is about to come to stage.
Really?
They
just opened Tarzan, haven't they?
They just opened Tarzan to not particularly nice reviews.
Right.
Which I think is the same way that Mary Poppins was greeted in the UK, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it's unfortunately proved to be a big hit.
Well, give audiences.
No stopping mediocrity.
It marches on.
Andrew Lloyd Webber set the standard of mediocrity. mediocrity, you know, it's fun.
Well, yeah, if Cats can run for years, then who can stop Mary Poppins?
Exactly.
Yeah, when is your stage musical coming?
You know, well, I don't know. We got Spamalot at the moment, which is, you know, Pipe and Light, but it's hugely successful. So it's marching, it's still in New York, it's marching around the States on tour. It's going to come to London in October, and it'll be opening in a permanent theater in Las Vegas for the New Year.
But that's kind of frightening, isn't it?
It's ridiculous, but I'm not really complaining because it's my pension fund.
But I guess that's the only way Python was going to get to Vegas.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Eric was determined to get there. That was his dream. I mean, the extraordinary thing about it, Eric has had two dreams, and they're now both being fulfilled. I mean, a hit on Broadway and Las Vegas, and he's getting them both. So
what's left for him now?
Yeah, in his autumn years, he's really come to the fore here.
Well, he's providing everyone's pension.
We all get a little something. Eric is, I can't imagine how rich he is now. I just don't even want to know him.
I wonder if John thinks the same thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, John must be dying because John lives for money, and Eric is raking it in.
I'm sure he has tea with Mel Brooks every once in a while and compares notes. I mean, when you look at that, but is there anything that, you know, any project of yours that you could ever see? Like, you know, Brazil, the musical?
Well, strangely enough, there's been odd people checking in to do a musical about Brazil or Munchausen. And they sort of float in. I don't know what, I usually say, well, fine, if you want to have a go at it, try it. And then I don't hear much more after that.
Because they obviously tried it and realized what pure insanity it was.
I mean, it's madness. I mean, you might be able to, you could pull off Munchausen, I think, but Brazil is ridiculous to try, it seems to me. Time Bandits, maybe they could do something with that.
Maybe the Time Bandits is Panto.
Yeah, no, I'll tell you what it is. It's got to be at that level. I mean, that's pretty much what Spamalot is. It's Panto. I find so much of the humor, to me, doesn't work as well as it did on film because, you know, on film it was filthy, it was shitty, and so the comedy came out of that. And so when you say, you know, how do you know he's a king? Well, he doesn't have shit all over him. It's not as funny because there's no shit on the stage, there's no mud, there's no, you know, the awfulness isn't there.
And you're looking at stars. There's no shit on Tim Curry.
Yeah, well, Tim was quite funny. Tim played it in an interesting way because it was like he wasn't quite there. he really does more important work in the theater. And so he did it was quite funny the way he went through it with his, always kind of this slight, twisted smile towards the audience, you know, like, you know, I shouldn't be doing this. That's better than this.
So he really was playing Panto.
It was, yeah, exactly.
Maybe that's what the allure was, is that, you know, America does not have a tradition of Panto.
It's possible. I mean, the stuff played much, much better than I'd ever expected it to play. The audience loved it. And it played to a Broadway audience as well, but it seems to be working, I think it's in Boston at the moment, in Chicago, moving around, so it seems to be, looks like it's going to continue to play around the country, but it really seemed aimed at a Broadway audience.
Do you think it would play on the West End?
Well, it's going to be here in October, so we'll find out.
And what are your thoughts? Do you think it will play to...
Well, the tickets are selling. That's all I know. I hesitate to make any predictions. I've been wrong so many times.
Well, you have to start making notes for Brazil the Musical.
Yeah, exactly. 12 Monkeys the Musical.
Fear and Loathing the Musical.
Ah, yes. Now we're talking.
I can see that happening.
Yeah.
Heck, you could even put Brothers Grimm on stage.
Ah, yes. That would work. We could do any number of things. I mean, people seem to want spectacle. They want to see stuff happening up there on the stage.
Check back next week for the next part of our QuickCast interview with Terry Gilliam. www.quickstopentertainment.com